People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A project based in the Comox Valley is tackling the stigma people who use substances can face when they go to the hospital. Vancouver Island University professor Sharon Karsten is part of a team working to strengthen connections between the local hospital and care networks in the community. A project called Walk With Me is central to that work. It gathers stories of people's firsthand experiences with issues like substance use and shares them with people who work in systems like the hospital with the goal of improving outcomes for everyone. I spoke with Sharon Karsten and Christopher Hauschild, a MyTax research fellow at VIU involved with the project, about what they've uncovered so far when it comes to stigma in the hospital.
My name is Sharon Karsten. I am a Michael Smith Health Research BC scholar at Vancouver Island University, a faculty member in recreation, tourism, and hospitality management. And I'm a researcher, a community engaged researcher. And so the brunt of my work happens in communities, largely small communities, and happens around the toxic drug crisis. I'm a member of the Walk With Me team. So that's the name of our research team. And we also have a nonprofit organization called Walk With Me. So it's this collaboration we run between university and nonprofit.
And my name is Christopher Hauschild. I am a MyTax research intern at Vancouver Island University. I'm also connected to the Walk With Me project. That's the focus of my work. The focus of my work is at the Comox Valley Hospital on this project, the harm reduction intensive. As well, I'm a master's student at Royal Roads University in the Global Leadership Program. And I come to this work as somebody with lived experience of poly substance use. It is the reason why I'm here. I've lost many, many friends to this crisis and have memories of what it is to experience stigma. And so I feel a lot of compassion and drive to address where possible, manifestations of this crisis and how it impacts people.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, for making some time to be here. Sharon, welcome to the program. Christopher, welcome back to the program. Maybe Sharon, to get us started, when someone who uses drugs shows up at the hospital, what kind of barriers might they face?
So we've been doing work on this issue for 6 or 7 years now. I guess it's been 7 years. And people who use substances face stigma broadly in community. And that's not new news, but I don't think the average person necessarily thinks about the kinds of barriers folks face when they enter into Emerge, for instance. So there's many different types of barriers, stigma being a key barrier. So people don't necessarily feel that they've been taken seriously, that their concerns are taken seriously. Some people are labeled as drug seeking when they enter into Emerge or other healthcare settings. And then there's issues around care continuum and how people are passed along to the next phase of their health journey. And oftentimes our systems of care are broken such that people are sort of discharged without appropriate connections with community organizations and so forth, which then in turn leads often to repeat visits into Emerge or other hospital or care sites. So it really is the project we're engaged with is trying to understand the nature of the system of care, trying to understand the nature of the stigma, and then finding pathways forward once we more fully understand what that looks like.
And you mentioned that this work has been ongoing for 6 or 7 years. Christopher, on this front, are there any examples maybe that have stuck with you or things that you've heard, things that either from this project or from other life experiences you've heard people talk about when it comes specifically to stigma in the hospital system and what that looks like? And when we say stigma in that context, what that actually means?
That is a great question, Joe. We've heard such a spectrum of responses from individuals who use substances, who have accessed care, sometimes good things. Sometimes people said that they felt seen, that they felt heard, that they had their care needs addressed. But it hasn't been uncommon across different communities and different hospital sites we've worked in when engaging with community members who use substances to hear comments like, "I would rather die than access the hospital," which I think speaks volumes to the degree of stigma that people are feeling. And stigma is, again, a spectrum, and it can be kind of hard to pinpoint necessarily like what that stigma actually looks like. Sometimes people report just feeling judged. You know, they walk in and they express what's going on, and they say like, "I've been labeled a substance user. People are looking down upon me." And that feeling of being judged kind of persists through care. And sometimes people will just say, "You know what? This is the worst day ever. I don't want to be here to begin with, and now I feel judged," and so they leave, which kind of compounds harm. So people, maybe they have a minor injury and they leave because they felt stigmatized or judged, and then they're having to access the hospital again in a few more weeks with a much more significant health concern.
Now, how does your work and your research enter into that equation? So you're maybe investigating what that stigma looks like, and then what?
So we've been really honored to work with leadership at the Comox Valley Hospital. First, I want to say that we are not working with the Comox Valley Hospital because there's a particularly poignant case of stigma or something like that at that site, but rather that the leaders at that site are open to exploring ways of improving services. And so what we've noticed in our work throughout Island Health, and we've been to many, many sites, is that stigma is an issue, and that folks who use substances are often reluctant to go to hospital. So now we found a site, and this comes from a deep relationship building over many years now of our team working with the Comox Valley Hospital, delivering what we called story walks, which are kind of experiential learning journeys featuring the voices of people with lived in and living experience. So we've taken many staff at the hospital on story walks. And through that relationship development, we were invited in to do this harm reduction intensive. And so what that looks like is 6 months of programming and research. So the programming involves story walks, taking teams throughout the hospital on story walks, and then doing some strategic visioning. So how is this site supporting people who use substances in a good way? Where are improvements needed? And so, in doing that story walk, we set the stage for a larger conversation about systems change with staff teams. And over the course of the last 6 months, we've had about 300 staff members come through our story walks and our strategic visioning sessions. And on top of those, we have workshops that we program. So we had a workshop with one of the peer support workers coming down from the Campbell River Hospital to talk about what that position is and how important that position is in that to that site. So we're looking at best practices and bringing people in who could really speak to those practices around what it means to hold space in a good way in these hospitals for people who use substances. We also had a physician come up from Royal Jubilee Hospital to talk to a group of physicians here at the Comox Valley Hospital. So we're really about holding space for learning around the toxic drug crisis, holding space for stigma reduction, but also improvements in services, and really creating, often in these sites, there's not room for this kind of dialogue, creative conversation around how can we do better, because the system is so pressurized. There's so many concerns on the daily that need to be addressed, that this kind of broader strategic planning doesn't always happen. So we were honored to hold that space over that 6 month period, and now are kind of consolidating our findings from that, all of the voices that contributed insights to the through the harm reduction intensive.
So you gathered these folks' experiences, you have brought them to folks who work at the hospital through a number of different channels. What have you been able to maybe see has happened as a result of maybe taking 300 folks who work in the hospital system on these story walks where they hear people's experiences in the places that they experience them?
I mean, there have been so many beautiful things that have happened from this project. Before launching the harm reduction intensive, we spent a good like 6 months plus kind of planning and organizing with different champions throughout the hospital. So, the site director, as well as like regional harm reduction coordinators and kind of other people who popped up as real advocates of this work. And through this series of planning conversations, there was a strengthening of a sort of network of relationships that were built. And people kind of became change agents. They were able to kind of see what the work was hoping to do and also see how it benefited them and their site and their teams. And so before kind of launching into this intensive, there was already quite a bit of buy-in and relationship. And we've seen those relationships and networks kind of grow. We've sparked what's called the Advocate Circle, which is a group that meets once a month. And it's anybody and everybody in the hospital can come to this meeting and can kind of explore issues that they're facing, challenges, barriers. But as well, what's really cool about it is being sort of a third space. We're part of what's called the North Island Research and Innovation Hub. Within the hospital, but being a third space, we're able to invite community organizations as well, which are a really important piece of this puzzle when talking about the continuum of substance use related care. Sometimes hospital staff have no idea who's on the other end of a pamphlet, but knowing that piece of information is the difference between somebody being held in a good way on the next leg of their care journey or sort of dropped. We talk about people falling through the cracks. And so by bringing in community organizations to sit in circle with care teams or clinical nurse educators, there's an opportunity to kind of explore how relationships from community and the hospital can be strengthened and how everybody can kind of work together to address commonly shared challenges. And for me, the most impactful thing has been to see these relationships develop. It's not new to hear of sort of the siloed nature of care services. We've heard this time and time again. We've explored this in past research, but to see that continuum become strengthened has been really impactful for myself, and I think for both community organizations and care teams. But there's other sort of facets of cool impacts that Sharon might want to touch on as well.
Maybe just to say that we are in early days, so we've just in June finished the harm reduction intensive, the 6 month period of intensive learning and dialogue and strategic planning and research. We did run a survey prior to the intensive with people with lived and living experience who had accessed the hospital. And we ran that same survey right at the end of the intensive. And so the early results from that survey, which we haven't yet published, but we are very pleased to see that that the markers did move in a positive way, that people are feeling more comfortable accessing services at the hospital. We're also just in the process of learning how staff have interacted with that intensive through a survey that we're unpacking right now. But some of the key pieces, that are being worked on right now include, clinical order sets. How are people, how does the mechanism within Emerge function in relation to serving the needs of people with lived and living experience? And there's a whole lot of work right now happening through clinical order sets on how that experience could be improved. There's another piece of work happening around potentially bringing a peer support worker into the hospital in some capacity. And what does that look like? So it's too early to say that particular, long-term aims have been achieved, but we are very hopeful based on what we're seeing and the kinds of initiatives that are springing forward, that there will be sort of long-term ramifications or progress from this intensive.
Now, Sharon, you mentioned that you happen to be doing this work at the Comox Valley Hospital. And if anything, it's maybe because there is a lot of buy-in from the folks in charge about hey, if we can improve our system, let's do it any way we can. That being said, if you're doing this work in the Comox Valley, what is the context there, or how might that work be different than if you were doing it at, say, I don't know, like St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver or something?
Yeah, it's worth just taking a moment to acknowledge that each community is unique, each site is unique, but that there are also some shared dynamics across and between sites. And so our team over the last few years, I don't think I've mentioned yet, has been traveling from hospital to hospital throughout Island Health, delivering our StoryWalk platform. So we've had an opportunity to sit in circle with many different staff teams now throughout the health authority. And So, I think at the root, this work we're doing at the Comox Valley Hospital is we consider it a pilot, in that, it's one thing to deliver story walks all across the island, and there's very, very powerful work happening there. But it's another to see a consolidated effort at a single site to create change, to really move the system. And that's what we're seeing at the Comox Valley Hospital. That's so exciting, is that people are seeing each other. And then it becomes not about, any one person or any one department making change. It's a collective effort where you have multiple players, kind of actors working together. And so that principle can be brought, I strongly believe, to other sites. And so what the harm reduction intensive, if it was brought to another site, would look like would likely be quite different than what we saw at the Comox Valley Hospital, because of the unique dynamics at each site. But there that's why there's a process of essentially community development prior to activating a project like this, where you sit and have conversations with folks at a site. What does this site need to move the dial in its care for people who use substances? So yeah, I mean, I think it's a pilot, but not one that can be easily sort of plunked down in any other place. You really need to take the time to listen to the unique needs and concerns or thoughts or imaginations or potentials. Like, not just to say this is only about concern, it's also about potential and imagination. And if you can cultivate that within a site, there's a really good case for systems change.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guests are Sharon Karsten and Christopher Hauschild. They're part of a project studying the stigma people who use substances can face when they go to the hospital. The project is based out of the Comox Valley, and Karsten is a professor at Nanaimo's Vancouver Island University. You talked about in there maybe this idea of like the whole culture of the hospital shifting. And I'm wondering if you could tell me more about that idea. I think of like, so if the topic today is how people who use drugs are affected by stigma when they go into the hospital, how would you describe an overall culture shift on that issue?
That is a great question. And I'll just kind of share one story that was really impactful for me. I was primarily facilitating many of the story walk and strategic visioning sessions. And we have to date now created like 13 different compilations of story tracks of different contexts, different places. And so in doing these sessions, we kind of ran through all of the different stories collections that we had. And we had compiled a series of stories around the trades. So trades-based context of people with lived experience in the trades, and playing it for nurses and hospital staff. There was a really interesting paradigm shift that happened where we came back and we walked by NIC, by their trades building, and people could hear the construction. And we went back into circle and people reflected, and the amount of people who were like, I have a family member who's in the trades. And, I didn't stop to think necessarily about the culture of substance use or the impetus to hide that substance use that exists for people in the trades, the compounding injuries. And so there was a moment where people were stretching themselves to be like, well, I've made assumptions about who perhaps is or isn't a substance user. And there was a recognition that the majority of people who are impacted by this crisis on the island are people, men aged 19 to 59, and often people in the trades. And so there's sort of an invisible demographic of people who use substances. One of the quotes on the tracks is like, I became really good at hiding it because if I didn't, I would lose my job. And so, there was a question among care staff of like, well, how do we identify people who are perhaps coming in and not disclosing their substance use, but are very much affected by it, are at risk of perhaps using at home and alone and at an increased risk of mortality? And so people were really shifting their perspective about who might be a substance user, and also grappling with the question of how do we deliver care to people who aren't necessarily disclosing it? I think oftentimes there can be like a laser focus on people who self-disclose as substance users or who might more visibly kind of fit the bill of who we might think a substance user is. But there isn't always a conversation or an imagining of the many, many, many other people in community who are also using substances who don't identify that way. And I think for me, it was super impactful to hear and see and witness in real time this sort of paradigm shift about imagining best care practices for anybody, because really anybody could be a substance user. And when I see people stretching to imagine their loved ones as being populations that are affected by this crisis, or people they know, to me, that's really humanizing people who are most at risk in this crisis. And I think that's really, really important in terms of culture shift, is being able to personally connect with a shared humanity to understand that it's not a crisis happening in isolation. It's not just a very localized demographic. It could really be just about anyone entering for any number of reasons who's at risk, and trying to treat everybody with the same standard of compassion and care that is warranted within a public health emergency. And so that was impactful to me as a moment of sort of witnessing culture shift. But Sharon, I'm sure you witnessed many things that I didn't. Was there anything you wanted to touch on regarding culture shifts?
No, thanks, Christopher. I think it's just about normalizing care for people who use substances. I mean, there's all these sort of underlying values and judgments that are kind of cultivated in our wider culture, not just in the hospital system, but in news media often, and in other places, that just become part of the fabric of how we as communities operate. And so when you can normalize care for people who use substances similar to cancer or diabetes, and people start to just, this becomes a place, it's just the status quo. It's like a day in the life of the hospital. This is normal. And we care for people no matter where they come from, no matter what they, you know, there's a great power in that. And so it involves bringing these conversations on the regular into staff meetings, into, you know, if there's a new substance that's hitting the streets that's particularly lethal, it's about making sure the staff know what that looks like. And so these kind of conversations need to become not abnormal. They need to become part of the fabric of a place. And that's where I think systems change often starts, is that normalization. And that process happens through kind of collective conversation.
Well, building on what both of you have just said there, if we're talking today on the radio about stigma that can affect people who use substances when they go to the hospital, I imagine everyone is going to have their own different image that pops into their head of what that means. And so is there any context you think it's important to provide for people on what that means and what that could look like? Like if we're even just talking about substance use or people who use substances, what is the context around what that means, what kinds of substances they might be using, or like what relation that might or might not even have to what they're going to the hospital for, and all sorts of different ways that that could be playing out? What kind of context is important around it, do you think?
So I think it's really important to point to the fact that we are in a public health emergency in relation to the toxic drug crisis, and we have for many years being in a public health emergency declared by this province. And so the emergency relates to the toxicity of the supply, and so fentanyl is a key driver of that toxicity. But now there's of course many other pieces to that equation, and many other substances being woven into the street supply that are really, really toxic. And so people are passing away at this astronomical rate. And so it's just worth noting that because that's the backdrop against which we're working and calling for change. Christopher?
Yeah, I was going to say substance use is nothing new. People have been using substances since they figured out substances they could use. Honestly, it is more recent, however, in the history of Canada that criminalization came about. I mean, the origins of criminalization in Canada exist within the Indian Act as a form of sort of punitive colonialism, and have grown from there. I think, you know, people, regardless of criminalization, regardless of moralization, will use substances for one of a million reasons, recreationally or because of injury, because of mental health issues, because of trauma. They might, you know, use substances. There are so many reasons which might compel people to use a spectrum of substances. The issue is that the unregulated drug supply has become so adulterated with poisoned unknown chemicals that, as Sharon mentioned, people are dying at alarming rates. And So I think regardless of whether or not people are sort of approaching the view of substance use with perspectives of moralization or criminalization, it doesn't remove the fact that people are going to use. And I personally don't believe that people's choice to use substances should be a death sentence. It's not a certain type of person who did this to themselves, as I've heard some people say, who are dying from this crisis. It's youth who are just kind of going out into the world at a party and experiencing peer pressure and dying. You know, I've heard of people as young as 11 or 12 or 13 passing away. And as well, it's people's grandparents who just try something new. There are many people who are losing their lives to this crisis, and it's compounding harm generationally. Last I checked, we're at about 19,000 people who have passed over the last 10 years, which is catastrophic and alarming. And I think sometimes that gravity is a bit swept under the rug. And again, sometimes I think the focus of who is passing away from this crisis is sort of misinterpreted or misunderstood. It's really anybody from any walk of life. And I think often it's those human stories from a diverse group of people that are really missing. In conversations about this crisis, it's often the case in the media that a certain type of person who often is unhoused is featured as somebody who might use substances. But really, there isn't always that opportunity, or often, and I find that opportunity to sit and to hear stories of lived experience and to really humanize what it is for diverse people to use substances. We don't hear the reasons why necessarily, or we don't hear the visions for change or what people's gifts are or what their visions for change are. But I think that that's a really important piece of this conversation amidst the crisis is human stories.
Well, from what you're seeing in this research project, how does the fact that there has been a declared public health emergency for more than 10 years now on this issue, how does that play into whether there is or is not stigma, or what that stigma looks like for people who use substances when they go to the hospital? Well, what changes because this has been a declared public health emergency for so long?
Yeah, I mean, it has been so long. And, you know, when the emergency was first declared, there was perhaps a bit of hope that we would have the resources similar to COVID, which was declared also as a provincial health emergency. And there was kind of a mobilization en masse to address that crisis. And there, of course, have been interventions and so forth rolled out provincially. One, of course, is criminalization, decriminalization, which sort of swung the dial back and then forth again on this issue. And so I think there's a fatigue that comes from the emergency persisting for so long without the adequate resources to address it. So we hear that in the health system. We hear that with people with lived and living experience. We hear that in the general public. And I think that there's some kind of tricky messaging that's come out with criminalization and decriminalization and recriminalization around sort of polarizing our communities on this issue. So we were kind of invited through that swing to align ourselves with one side or another. And what that alignment does is it kind of reduces our capacity to be human. I think it's like we're kind of invited into like a pit fight or something like that. It feels that way sometimes entering into, you know, whether it's conversations with between business, the business community and the harm reduction community, or conversations with, you know, community care providers and municipal provider. Anyway, it's as though we've been invited to position ourselves oppositionally in this debate. And really, when you think of any systems change, what's needed is to bring all voices together. We can address this issue when we bring our voices together and bring our imaginations together in a spirit of like no one person knows the answer here. We need to rely on each other. So I know that maybe sounds utopian, but I mean, we need to find those spaces. We need to create those spaces in order to make progress on this issue.
Well, have you seen, you said you've been doing this work for 6 or 7 years now, and it sounds like you feel that there has been some kind of an impact from gathering people's stories of experience with substance use and how that has played into their experiences at the hospital, and then sharing those stories kind of en masse with hospital staff and the people kind of coordinating the hospital system. That has made an impact. You feel like the hospital, in a substantive way, has the culture around it has changed as a result of the work that you've both been doing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm reluctant to take credit for what I see as a community movement. And so we are just supporting folks who are really doing this work on the daily, in a frontline capacity, working with folks who may not be there the next day. It is heavy work, and I just want to pay huge respect to those who are working in this crisis, including peers who are saving lives on the daily. So I'm really reluctant to take some kind of credit for moving the dial here. What I would like to say is that we are honored and privileged to walk alongside folks in this journey, to support where we can, and that there is I am hopeful about the power of storytelling, the power of community engaged research, the power of bringing people together across these ideological lines. We've sat with many mayors and councils in circle alongside people with lived and living experience. And when you can see those ideologies start to dissolve, man, that's powerful. And so, no, I don't want to take credit for it, but do I want to say that there's a glimmer of hope here? Absolutely. Christopher?
Yeah, Sharon, I love that. I love leading with not taking credit, because it really isn't one actor or one small group of actors. It's all of our community members who have shown up to be a part of this initiative, who have taken the time to sit in sometimes uncomfortable stories, sometimes uncomfortable conversations, to really understand the complexity of the crisis, the complexity of the drivers that are pushing this crisis, and to sit with that complexity and kind of understand that there's more going on than we might initially think, and to work towards a spirit of kind of trying to address our local crisis as it manifests locally. I think that many dials can be kind of turned to improve health outcomes for people with lived and living experience of substance use. And we're doing that work. And it's not just us, it's many other actors. And yeah, to sort of be able to sit with community members who do use substances and do access the hospital and hear and see through data that, you know, people seem to be having better experiences. That to me is the most important sort of measure of whether or not our systems of culture are improving, our systems of care cultures are improving.
Sharon Karsten and Christopher Hauschild speaking with me about a community engaged research project aimed at understanding and addressing the stigma people who use substances can face in the hospital system. That research is headquartered at the Comox Valley Hospital and is affiliated with Vancouver Island University, where Karsten is a professor.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
So far on today's program, we've heard from a pair of folks connected to a project investigating the stigma that can occur when people who use substances go to the hospital. That project is based out of the Comox Valley. One person they've connected with over the course of their work is Corey Cliff, who's a little further up the island near Campbell River. He spoke with me about the value that peer workers can have in moving the needle on this issue.
Yo, nu ho'om yakelagilis. Gayuklin lak klamatach, Gukwilin lak klamatach, Hatman glee glue glue, Wilson glue cliff. Hello, everybody. My name is Corey Cliff. I come from the territory of the Liquitao people in Campbell River area. My ancestral name is Yekelagulis, and my family origins come from the Wilson clan of Cape Mudge and the Cliff family of Campbell River, the village of Klamatach.
And you have generously agreed to give me some of your time to talk about the issue of stigma faced by people who use drugs when they go into the hospital. Maybe to begin, could you tell me maybe where you're coming at this issue from?
Well, I come to this issue with lived experience as well as a few experiences in the hospital. At the age of 14, 15 years old, I was a heavy drug user, living in another country, eventually ended up on the streets for a little while as a youth, just for a couple of months, but it was enough of a taste to, you know, see how bad it can really be. Had a few experiences at Campbell River Hospital. Have some close friends who work within the industry, so I do have a bit of opinion about it.
Now, if you were trying to introduce someone to this issue who maybe doesn't have connections in their immediate family or their close life, either to folks who are spending a lot of time in the hospital or folks who are in the hospital system, what kind of context would you want them to have? How would you set the scene of what this issue of stigma faced by people who use drugs is like?
I think I would open it by saying a lot of people working in healthcare are burnt out. They're tired. And that's translating to a lot of things that are trickling down into the people who are going to visit the healthcare practitioners. You know, the overloading of the system and, you know, honestly, I haven't paid enough attention to funding cuts and things like that this year, but I do know that doctors, nurses, hospital staff are stretched to the limit right now. And there's not enough room for them to get additional training that they need to be working with people in you know, this situation. So when I see people go into, for example, Campbell River Hospital, there are a few liaisons that are great to work with. You know, they're fantastic human beings who work there because they genuinely care. But for the most part, you know, when they meet frontline workers, they do face a lot of stigma. And a lot of times it turns into a very bad experience. I'm one of those people who has, I actually wasn't using at the time, but I've gotten some very harsh treatment at the hospital. Unconfirmed whether or not it was, you know, due to stigma or what, but I did go in, you know, wearing all my bush clothes, literally still having strands of cedar stuck to my shirt from all the sap. But the treatment, you know, when you get there, it was, this is going back 3 years, but it was very dehumanizing. You know, with an empty waiting room and you could see into the secondary waiting room, it was empty. You know, there was absolutely no need for me to receive the treatment that I did. And, you know, following that, as I started to pay more attention and working in the addiction sector, I started to notice people that I know going in there and, you know, seeing the treatment that they receive. And, you know, a lot of times it's completely unnecessary. So I sit back and I ask myself, what is the root cause of these problems? So with people stretched so thin, how do we get them additional training, sensitivity training? That honestly, I believe that's one of the most important things that healthcare workers, especially frontline workers, you know, in the hospital, things like that, should be receiving on a regular basis. Because once a year, you know, that's kind of a minimum. But that reconnection to, you know, those empathetic pathways and relearning the word sympathy, that's important because they're working with people in their most vulnerable state. You know, this isn't like a correction center. You know, you should not be getting that hard treatment. But in a lot of cases, you feel it.
You talk about training, sensitivity training there. Could you tell me a little bit about what that could be like or what some of the things it would cover are?
Well, this is the perfect opportunity for me to shout out to the Walk With Me team and the concept behind their research, because that tool is so valuable. For those of you who haven't heard about Walk With Me, what we do is we record the stories of people who
are currently suffering in addictions or post-addictions in recovery. And we utilize those stories to educate people who have no idea what it feels like, no idea what people go through on a day-to-day basis. So it makes it easier to understand where people are coming from when they step through those doors into the emergency room or the clinic or whatever it may be. You know, that's just one form of training, but there's so many forms. Actually, no, there's not a whole bunch, but there's a few forms of sensitivity training. There's cultural sensitivity training, which is so valuable right now. You know, building relationships with the local nations brings a sense of peace into the establishment. I've seen the way that places like Likuta Health and more indigenous-based medical systems operate. And it's not to say that it's more sophisticated or anything like that. It's actually just, it's more of the clinic scene. But having that openness to spiritual connection, knowing that, you know, the indigenous people of the territory openly embrace you being in the hospital, you know, praying to your creator or this or that, and that cultural protocol has been taken care of, changes the complete atmosphere of the whole area. So, you know, there's the cultural sensitivity training. Of course, there's addiction sensitivity training, which in my mind, that's kind of where Walk With Me more sits in the sense of training. You know, I believe the team refers to it as research and maybe kind of an experiment. I don't spend enough time with the big boss to really pick her brain about the vocabulary behind it, but the concept is a beautiful thing. I've listened to some of the stories. I can't listen to them anymore, even though, you know, I sit in on the walks almost every session, because it really tugs at the heartstrings and it lets you know all of the things that you may not have known or felt. And it kind of puts you in those shoes for just a split second. The ability to do that, to transport somebody into the shoes of the storyteller, you know, that's where understanding begins.
This is People First Radio. Today's program is on the issue of the stigma that people who use substances can face when they go to the hospital. Right now, I'm speaking with Corey Cliff. He's been involved with a community-engaged research project called Walk With Me that's been attempting to address this issue in the Comox Valley. We're talking about this issue of stigma faced by people who use drugs when they go into the hospital. We've just talked about ways we could address that. What happens if we don't address that? What are the consequences for everyone on both sides of that equation of not addressing this issue of stigma faced by people when they go into the hospital?
That's kind of a deep one, but I've seen the consequences of it. You know, when I've seen people go into the hospital, and I personally know somebody who, actually he's not from this reserve, but he's from the Campbell River area, previously had an addictions problem. And, you know, the poor guy went into, I understand the pain because I recently had my gallbladder removed, but he was going through gallstones and he was begging and begging for something stronger. And, you know, I know from experience that it takes some time for them to actually schedule you a surgery. I visited the emergency room like every 3 nights for, oh, probably 4 months because of my gallstones before I was actually able to get in for surgery. So to know that somebody was nearing that volume of visitation, going there begging for something stronger, and because of you know, him having a previous history with addictions, not having access to those things because, you know, so-and-so says so, or this person says so, you know, there, of course, there's a risk of somebody relapsing because they needed to get medical assistance. But, you know, I think back to, you know, this guy's status going up day after day after day, and seeing him around town. He lived by himself. No, you know, he didn't have a partner or anything to take care of him. So to see him around town shopping and going through what he did, and then later on feel it. Like I understand how much anguish he must have gone through. And it's not just at that point, it's not just physical pain. It starts to become a mental thing, because at some point you're going through so much pain, you're laying there asking yourself, what did I do to deserve this? And for somebody who's done the work and cleaned up his life and worked hard and was over 5 years clean, to go through that kind of a situation while he's begging for the medicine, you know, that's a hard one to process. And that sticks in my mind all the time whenever I'm discussing this issue. You know, my previous history with drugs, thank goodness it wasn't with opioids, but it opened my eyes to a lot of the other side of, you know, the stigma of recognizing addiction in each other. And I think it's important to have people, you know, who are living in recovery, working within that system as peer counselors to help walk people through that system, and honestly, to help protect them, to help create understanding amongst the staff, because the change has to come from, you know, from within the system.
Could you tell me more about that role of peers working in the healthcare system? Like what you have been able to do, or you have seen other people be able to do on this issue that we're talking about? What is the change that can happen when there is a peer there somehow in the system?
So Campbell River Hospital has some liaisons working there, and they have experience in addictions. We don't particularly have any peers at our hospital, but I've seen the effects of having peers working within any system. I've also talked to some peers that have worked in other towns within the system, but the importance of having that in place breaks down a lot of barriers, not just for the staff who need to come to understand certain situations, but also for the people coming in. There's always been a longstanding mistrust between my people and the healthcare system. Now, this is something that is easily translatable to the addictions community as well. So having liaisons in place lets people know that they are in a safe place. Having those peer support workers in place lets, you know, people post addictions or currently suffering with addictions, let them know that there is somebody there who's advocating for them. And that's important, you know, that those words, "I'm here for you," carry a lot of weight when you go into a system completely nervous, high anxiety, wondering, you know, are they going to treat me this way, or am I just going to be treated like the average Joe today? Knowing that that person is there, and I've actually seen people's face when the liaisons walk in and they smile. I've seen somebody who was in absolute pain smile when they seen the liaison walk in the room. And it's because of that connection. It was an Indigenous liaison, so it's a cultural support walking into the room, but it's the same effect. You know, we're talking about a way to disarm somebody and bring them to a comfort level where doctors and nurses can confidently go in and comfortably administer whatever kind of treatment is needed. And it honestly creates a safer atmosphere for everybody. Nobody likes conflict. Nobody likes to get into an argument about, you know, doctor's care versus patient's comfort level. So yeah, the peer supports, liaisons, I wish Island Health was in a place where they could expand on these supports, because I know that the ones working at the Campbell River Hospital, even though they are fantastic human beings, they're stretched thin, so they could definitely use more supports. And if Campbell River Hospital needs more support like that, then that could only mean that Courtney, or sorry, Comox, Nanaimo, Victoria, you know, all the other hospitals need that same support. But if we got those in place, I think there would be an atmosphere change, and it would relieve a lot of tension among staff that are feeling burnt out, and patients who are also kind of feeling burnt out with the system.
As you were talking there, it got me thinking about the idea that maybe typically, even just like the built environment of hospitals, we have this idea that it's very clinical, very different than like your house would look in an ideal world, etc. And you've talked so far about, you know, the health system is kind of stretched. Yeah, as you were talking, it got me thinking about like the impact of having the capacity to make these spaces like a little more human for the people working in them, the people coming there and seeking care. Do you think that is really like at the core of this, is finding ways to make the system more suited to human relationships?
Absolutely. You know, I do think, now that you mention it, I do think that a big part of the issue is that, you know, it's very, I know it's healthcare, and I mean, the word clinic is totally a part of it, but it's too clinical. It's too, you know, cut and dry, black and white. You know, I'm just thinking back to my childhood. My doctor in Ladner, a small town that I grew up in on the mainland, you know, I was very close with him. My mom was very close with him. He delivered me. He was there for me until I was like 10 years old. And then I visited him a few times after. And, you know, that personal, we didn't hang out outside of appointments, but, you know, those that personal connection, that doctor taking the extra step to get to know me, you know, genuinely cared. That was important. So I think that forming these connections within the system is important. And I don't think it happens enough now that we're on the topic.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you think individual people can do to sort of move the dial on this issue when so much of it is a systemic kind of thing?
What can an individual do to move the dial forward on this? I love that question. In my town, and this isn't to say it's the same in every other town, I'm not afraid to go and my fiance can say the exact same thing. We're not afraid to walk through downtown Campbell River in the middle of the night, alone, unarmed. And it's because the work started with conversation. And it's progressed to the point where when we walk around now, people introduce us to the new people instead of us having to introduce ourselves. I haven't had anybody ever come onto my property and steal anything, even though I live a 30-second bike ride from the heart of where everything's happening. And it's because we communicate with people. For those of you who don't know, my fiance, as well as 9 other phenomenal groups of people, have been feeding the people of Campbell River downtown, the unhoused population, for just over a year. You know, through rain, sleet, and snow, they set up a tent every night, actually 6 nights a week, and made sure that the people were fed. Those connections, talking to people about, you know, this was donated by this person from Wewakum First Nation. All baked goods were made by Granny Gwen. These are things that build connection, whether or not you stand there and have conversation, or you're just understanding that this particular group of people did this tonight and it took care of me. That's a form of introduction. Open the conversation. Don't be afraid. Sometimes it's not the right time, and that is totally understandable. But the guy who's standing outside Superstore, you know, asking for a buck, even if you don't have a buck, you know what's equally as valuable is recognizing that person. You know, a lot of times, and I know this from personal experience, you feel invisible. The opposite of addiction is connection.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on this issue of stigma faced by people who use drugs when they go to the hospital?
It's always a fine line, because there are, of course, the people who like to take advantage of the system. And that's unfortunate. But there's a lot of people that currently suffer unnecessarily because of that stigma. If it were any other person going through any other type of situation where they weren't receiving proper health care, people would be up in arms. So where it kind of leads me to a question of, like, where is the balance between recognizing user activity and dealing with it in a different way, or the people who are genuinely in need of care? Because even that person who goes into the hospital looking to be able to take care of their substance needs still needs some kind of care. They're not the addict that you kick out to the street. They're not any less than anybody else. It's just a different form of care that they need. I think if people could understand that, and that is their first go-to in their thought processing, would make a lot of change within the system.
Corey, Cliff, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today on this.
Thank you for having me.
Corey Cliff is a father of three, a self-described forest person, bonus dad, and uncle to an army of nieces and nephews. He lives in the Campbell River area. He's also been helping out with a community-engaged research project called Walk With Me out of the Comox Valley. One of their aims is improving care outcomes for people who use substances when they visit the hospital. That's all the time we have for this show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.